Would we rather be illusioned or disillusioned? Would we rather see the world through rose-colored glasses, not seeing what's in front of us? Or would we rather deal with reality the way it is? In the final chapter, I quote James Baldwin, the great, great James Baldwin, who said that not everything that's faced can be healed, but nothing that's not faced can be healed. And we have to just face how it is. We have to begin with that. And then we have to bring in our humanity, our activism, our advocacy on a social level, and look at the problems that we're facing and realize that they're not isolated problems restricted to individual pathologies, but a whole social issue that we need to face together.
Dr. Gábor Maté, the acclaimed Canadian physician and author who wrote the new book with his son Daniel, The Myth of Normal: Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. And that does it for our show. To see all our interviews with Dr. Maté, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, and Ermine Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari A. Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Mary Conlon. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on: the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for praxis.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Plains Cree singer-songwriter Buffy St. Marie remains a creative force as she enters her ninth decade. The trailblazing artist is the subject of an American Masters profile now out on PBS. It includes one-on-one interviews with her and her contemporaries, including Joni Mitchell and Robbie Robertson, and other musicians like Jeremy Dutcher, who look to her as an inspiration. We'll talk with Buffy St. Marie and have a few surprises. That's coming up after the news. We're saying, keep playing. We're praying.
It ain't money. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A boarding school healing ceremony was held in Anchorage, Alaska this fall. The ceremony took part as people from across the state gathered for the 2022 First Alaskans Institute's Elders and Youth Conference.
Took all their regalia.
Storyteller and cultural bearer Bob Sam from Sitka opened up the healing event by sharing some history of boarding schools in Southeast Alaska, from the early opening of the Sheldon Jackson School to students who were sent to the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania. Sam says it was devastating for students to be stripped of their languages and cultures. He also shared some stories of boarding school survivors talking about the trauma they endured. Students were often told they were worthless, and many were physically, mentally, and sexually abused.
And when they arrived in Carlisle, it had to have been the worst experience of their life.
Sam, who works on repatriation efforts, has brought home the remains of many students. He says that work and his overall research of U.S. Indian boarding schools has caused him much trauma. He spent many years in Japan learning about Japanese culture. He then returned home to Alaska, embracing his Tlingit culture to help him heal from the trauma.
Primarily, I return bodies and stuff like that, but I began to listen to the survivors and the people who suffered from the trauma of boarding schools, and from there I developed a ceremony.
Sam put on his traditional regalia, which he says is part of the healing process, describing each piece from his tunic to an orange apron representing Every Child Matters, a robe, and a woven headband representing Indigenous boarding school students in Canada. Sam then told a story about Raven and the return of traditional knowledge to the people. Sam ended the ceremony by having people form two lines. Boarding school survivors then walked down and were given affirmations, handshakes, and hugs from each person. As Sam sang, I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Department of Interior is continuing its investigation into U.S. Indian boarding schools. The agency is traveling across the country gathering testimony. This fall, a stop was made in South Dakota, as Lee Strubinger reports.
78-year-old Rosalie Quickbear attended one of the 31 boarding schools located in South Dakota. The Sechangu Lakota describes being powdered with the pesticide DDT, spending weeks with an untreated broken leg, and getting locked in a dark cement cellar for days. Quickbear describes her experience like this to her grandkids.
You see all this horror stuff on TV? Real bad? That's how we grew up. That's why we're like we are.
Quickbear says her experience at St. Francis Indian Boarding School still affects her.
I thought there was no God. Just torture.
Another survivor says every boarding school story is similar. Cheryl Angel also spoke.
We were treated inhumanely.
It's stories like this the Department of Interior is collecting as part of the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative. The initiative hopes to identify marked and unmarked burial sites from across the boarding school system. Interior Secretary Deb Holland was also in attendance. She says the tour is one step among many
that we will take to strengthen and rebuild the bonds within Native communities that the Federal Indian Boarding School policies set out to break.
I'm Lee Strubinger in Mission, South Dakota.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You've probably seen those car ads. Low price, low payments. But when you get to the dealer, there could be a catch. If a dealer isn't honest when it comes to its car ads, tell the Federal Trade Commission at reportfraud.ftc.gov. Support by the Federal Trade Commission.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Board promotes Indian artists of federally recognized tribes through its online source directory. Information on this no-charge opportunity available at doi.gov/IACB, who support this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Buffy St. Marie is the definition of a trailblazer. As a bold songwriter and folk musician on fire in the 1960s and 70s, she told it like it was. She commented on discrimination, violence in war, politics, and indigenous issues, and her music was even blacklisted for a short time in the U.S. She used the spotlight to share with the world the status of indigenous communities and dismantle as many Native stereotypes as she could. Buffy is an Academy Award winner, a multi-Juno Award winner, and a dear friend of Big Bird and everyone else on Sesame Street. And she's still sharing her music, art, and wisdom with the world. She's inspired many of today's indigenous musicians. The PBS series American Masters now offers a portrait of her genius and her many accomplishments. In this special pre-recorded show, we're talking with Buffy St. Marie about what's new and the latest in her life. And without further ado, please let me honor and welcome our guest today, Buffy St. Marie, Cree songwriter, musician, and activist. She's speaking with us from her home studio in Hawaii. Buffy, welcome back to Native America Calling. It's so great to have you on the show again.
Hey, Sean. Hi, everybody. That was very nice words you said. Thanks.
Well, it's a script, you know. I can't kick the training wheels off quite yet. But, well, Buffy, that's a really beautiful studio you have there. And I see you've got some new children's books in the background, your guitars, all your gear. So is that where you you work there every day and create and produce still?
I work here when I feel like it. That's the key to me. I do it when it's fun. I try not to turn it into work.
Well, that's definitely the attitude for sure. Well, Buffy, there's just so much to talk about. This is so cool and exciting. But first up, this documentary that's come out, it's been produced, and it's all about your life. And tell us more about it.
Oh, well, it was directed by Madison Thomas, who's half Indigenous, half non. And the writer is Andrea Warner. And Andrea Warner is the person who actually, she was the second biographer who went to my manager and said that she wanted to write the story of my life. And I asked my manager, well, who is it who wants to do a biography? He said, Andrea Warner. And I said, just say yes. Because we had done a little interview, kind of like what you and I are doing today, Sean, and neither one of us wanted to get off the phone. So Andrea is the writer, Madison Thomas is the director. And we had two production companies, White Pine, who were a major Canadian film production company, and Eagle Vision, who are an Indigenous group from Manitoba, who've been making great, great movies for quite a while. So I really lucked out. Had good people.
I had a chance to watch it yesterday, and I learned so much. Oh, I mean, I've always been pretty familiar with your career and followed your music, but there were just so many new insights. And I think what really struck me more than anything else, Buffy, is how long you have been in the industry, going back to the early 60s, and you've never wavered, you've never changed. And I think, you know, nowadays there's so many people, and they talk about decolonization, and they talk about the importance of Native culture and pride, but Buffy, you were singing and stating that message long before it was cool. I mean, you were really, really such a pioneer and so many years ahead of your time. And where did that strength and that courage and that vision, where do you think it comes from?
Just being interested, I think. I just really, really wanted to know. Like when I was a little kid, I was told two things. I was told, number one, you can't be a musician because you can't read European notation, which of course is the other side of the brain from a naturally gifted musician. And I was shunned and shamed in music classes. They told me I couldn't ever be a musician. And I'd go home and I'd play fake Tchaikovsky. And they also told me I couldn't be Indigenous because there aren't any more Indians. You know, we have vanished or something. I was raised in Maine and Massachusetts. So I think knowing those two things as a kid let me know that sometimes the world is wrong, or adults are wrong, or the authorities are wrong. Or I think I got it quite early in my head that sometimes people aren't always correct. And I became a teacher. I went to the University of Massachusetts. I got a degree in Oriental philosophy and religion. I thought I was going to be a philosophy professor. And I also got a teaching degree, and I practiced taught grade one. So when I was first starting out, I went into this vacuum of Greenwich Village where, you know, it was like preppy guys singing Michael Row the Boat Ashore and Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley, you know, the American songbook folk music, Woody Guthrie songs. Bob Dylan was singing Woody Guthrie songs, you know, Joan Baez, people like that. But I came with this whole other experience and background, and I was singing Now That the Buffalo's Gone and Universal Soldier and Codeine and songs that were really didn't come from anywhere except personal experience. And I think that I had the courage to get on a stage because I was really a nobody, just because of the content of the songs. And I really felt as though, like something like Now That the Buffalo's Gone, this is in New York City. And Now That the Buffalo's Gone is about the building of Kinzua Dam, which is in upper New York State. And I was singing to, you know, quite wealthy people who, you know, thought they were really woke and hip, white people mostly. And they had never heard anything they had never heard anything about Indigenous realities. They were living in the world where Indians don't exist. And when I sang Now That the Buffalo's Gone, the attitude of audiences was, the little Indian girl must be mistaken. She must be mistaken. Because there was really no, there was no such thing as indigeneity. They had, right. It had never crossed their screens. Their own professors had never been educated about us. So I came as a teacher, you know, as a first grade teacher, not well, to Buffy, scold an audience, but I think it's because I did have that. And then number one, I had a sense of fun and I enjoyed being an entertainer. I didn't want to be a lecturer.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, how did, you know, here you were, your life seemed to follow this pretty standard trajectory of going to college and becoming a school teacher, and then boom, you just totally just threw the script out and you take off to New York City, early 1960s, pre-Beatnik era. And I mean, what was it that made you take that leap of faith and just completely just go a different direction with your life?
Well, I loved making music, and there was an opportunity in the early 60s, you know, just after the Beatniks and long before the hippies. There was an opportunity for a young person right out of college to get on a stage and play my songs that I'd been writing all my life. So it's not as though I suddenly changed and turned into an entertainer. No, I just never drank the Kool-Aid that said that you can't do that. I thought it was fun. I thought it was fun. And I wasn't going for a career, you know. I wasn't raised like Paul Simon in a music business family where your uncle owns a music thing and your other uncle is a lawyer. I had never met a lawyer. I was really green, so I really didn't know any better. But like when I was growing up and being told that I couldn't be a musician, couldn't be an Indian, couldn't be this, you know, my mom said, you grow up and you go find out for yourself. And that's kind of what college was about. And when I was, maybe sophomore or junior in college, I went to Washington, D.C., and I ran into the National Indian Youth Council. Now, these guys are right up my alley, and they just love me. It was like Mel Tom, Clyde Warrior, Walter Funmaker, Thelma Stiffarm, you know, real pioneers. Now, these were young college people like me. They were getting law degrees. Some of them were getting their master's in law. So you put my experience with their experience, and we had some things to talk about. So I had that going into the music business. I wasn't interested in being any of the other girls singers or boy singers. I mean, I wasn't interested in that. I was interested in being effective. I thought it was so, so exciting to be learning from my peers. By that time, I was traveling to different reservations. When I was first starting to sing, I went to, you know, I got some airplane tickets to go to places like Stockholm and Paris. When I was done with my concerts, I'd fly up and spend time with Indigenous people in the north, you know, 30 degrees north of the Arctic Circle with Sami people. Or in Australia, I'd be with Aboriginal people just because I loved it. And it was so much fun. So it kind of got reflected into my music. And it was a special time when there were coffee houses. And that's important because there's no alcohol. And young people could attend. They put an end to that pretty fast. You know, by the end of the 60s, it was no longer coffee, talk, 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 listen, 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 and a little pot. You know, that's the way the early 60s were. By the end, it was alcohol and hard drugs. And coffee houses had gotten liquor licenses, and the youth movement was effectively shut up. Me too, for different reasons. But yeah, that's kind of how I got into it, just because I was so curious myself, and I loved telling other people, and I thought, if only they knew, they'd help. And in some cases, they did. Mm.
Well, you know, those early days of because you're talking about Mel Tom and Clyde Warrior, National Indian Youth Council. I mean, those were the early leaders of what became the American Indian Movement later and activism. I mean, that was the very beginnings, the roots of that. And I mean, did you folks face a lot of resistance? Were people like, did people push back when you went out there publicly and shared your messages through your music and through the comments that you would make? Was there pushback?
It's funny, it almost not even got to the point of being pushback. It was all done under the table. Like being blacklisted and, you know, being under FBI surveillance. you know, I always correct people when they say, Buffy, you must hate the U.S. government for having blacklisted your career. The U.S. government doesn't blacklist careers. That would be legal. They would have to get an act of Congress for the government to do that. No, you have a Republican administration, a Democrat administration. They have cronies in the back room making phone calls to the network, to the media. You know, Floyd Westerman and Charlie Hill, they got this too. You know, they, like, we were never encouraged to play in Indian country much. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was real famous on the East Coast and the West Coast and the rest of the world, but not in the heartland. I wasn't invited to play through, you know, Montana, the Dakotas, you know, Oklahoma, Wyoming. I wasn't known there. We were kept quiet. Who was it who controlled the university concert series? Who were that?
I'm not sure, but Buffy, we're going to have to take a break. Just stay with us, folks, and we will be right back with Buffy St. Marie. It seems like Black Friday got going weeks ago, but we'll take the traditional start of the holiday shopping season to talk about the vision of some native retailers, including two hard-charging botanical creators. It's that time of year to highlight small native business on the next Native America Calling.
Did you know more than 51,000 Native and Indigenous people are living with epilepsy in the United States? Epilepsy is a neurological disorder that causes recurring, sudden, unprovoked surges of abnormal electrical activity in the brain. Call 1-800-332-1000 to get information and resources. Help someone you know by learning seizure first aid at epilepsy.com/first aid. The Epilepsy Foundation supports this show.
This is a special pre-recorded episode of Native America Calling. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. We're talking with the one and only Buffy St. Marie. She's a talented and influential artist. We're not taking live callers, but you're more than welcome to join the conversation online. We're on Facebook and Instagram. And we've got a caller right now, Radmila Cody, a name many of us are familiar with. She's a Diné singer, songwriter, as well as a model, and raises awareness to fight against domestic abuse and violence. She's a Grammy nominee and multiple Native American Music Awards winner. Radmila, thanks for calling in today.
Yate, Buffy. Oh my gosh, this is an honor. Aww. It's good to hear your voice. It's good to just be sharing this space with you over the phone and to hear. Yeah, awesome. Good to. It's yate. I'm trying to not get too nervous because the last time I saw you, I was feeling the same way. I was like, oh God, Buffy St. Marie.
I felt the same way, Radmila. Radmila, what does that mean? What is Buffy's music and her career and just everything about her mission and just her vision? What does it mean to you?
Oh man, it's not just me, but to just Native country in general. It's, you know, your work has focused so much on issues facing Indigenous peoples and you know, the social environmental activism linked to that, and you've just really been indeed a trailblazer for many of us who you've created and opened those opportunities in that path for. So I'm very, very grateful to you for that. I remember that the first time I met you, it was years back at the film festival in the American Indian Film Festival in San Francisco. And you had done a performance, and I believe they had given you an award there, but I was just so excited and nervous about meeting you, and then I remember saying to you, I'm going to be just like you, Buffy. Like you. And you had a smile on your face, and you said, well, good luck, Red Villa. And I remember thinking to myself in that moment, like, well, she's right, right? Like, you're right about that, because there's so much that you have done in your career, and there's no, I can't be like Buffy. I can't be like you, even Whitney Houston, because I love and adored Whitney, you know, adore Whitney Houston. And so I think in that moment, I remember just feeling even more inspired by you, because you made me realize in that moment that I needed to focus on creating a path of my own. And so thank you for that. Thank you for that moment. And I appreciate, again, everything that you have done and continue to do for, you know, Indigenous peoples, and just being a good relative, you know, on so many levels in that way, and for our land, for our non-human relatives, you know, just, you know, for our life ways, you know, this goes way back, you know, during an era where so much injustice was placed, you know, on Black Indigenous people and in Indigenous people. And so there's a photo that I love, I absolutely love, where you're sitting at a piano next to to Muhammad Ali, and it's one of my favorite images of you. And I always wondered what that moment was like for you. What conversation took place in that moment? It was Muhammad Ali, and there were some other individuals that were there as well. But I always wondered what that moment was like for you.
Pretty wonderful. Muhammad Ali was a friend of mine and very kind to me. He used to come to my shows and sit way in the back, and then we'd go for walks. This was in Washington, D.C. We'd go walking around at night after the show. I could say a lot about him. He's wonderful. In that picture also, if I recall, is Dick Gregory. He came to my reserve, and he told me in the airplane on the way home, he was crying, and he said that he thought that he had seen inequity, but he had never seen anything like what he saw in Saskatoon, you know. Also in the picture was Richie Havens, David Amram, Stevie Wonder, Marlon Brando. Yeah, it's a really nice picture. It's a famous picture. Muhammad Ali and Ken Norton, the picture was taken, they had volunteered to do a 14-round exhibition bout in Washington, D.C. for the longest walk. So that's why that picture was taken. That's what it was around. And Sheldon Wolfchild and his brother, Ernie Peters, Long Walker, and members of the American Indian Movement set up the longest walk, and that was the culmination. But I loved what you said. Thank you so much for mentioning that you thought that I had inspired you to walk your own way, because I wrote a song. My first album was called It's My Way, and it means it's my path, it's my dream, it's my it's what I embrace, it's my responsibility that I love, you know, it's my way. A lot of people thought they got it confused with the Paul Anka song that Frank Sinatra sang, I'm doing my way, god damn it, my way, right? So no, it's not like that. It's an Indigenous approach, not my way, it's my way. It's my path, and I'm so glad that you got it. Thank you, Radmila.
Radmila, thank you for calling in today. Really appreciate your kind words for Buffy. And Buffy, it's interesting because you have the ability to just, and I read an article, and they said that you were quoted as saying, I can turn any song into a peace song. I mean, the most hardcore song, doesn't matter what it is. And like, you even recorded that theme song from The Sopranos, didn't you? And turned it into like a whole different theme.
I did, yeah. The theme song from The Sopranos, woke up this morning, got yourself a gun, right? That was written by a wonderful group of guys called Alabama Three, who are British, and there were seven of them. I don't know why they called Alabama Three, but they wrote another song called Power in the Blood. And there have been many songs called Power in the Blood. A lot of them are Christian religious songs. But their Power in the Blood was all about swords and blood and violence. And I just loved the song. So I got in touch with them and I said, they were fans of mine. And I was at a concert in London and I had never met them. And they came in. And their lead singer was walking on his knees and making a big deal out of it. So we had a lot of fun. We stayed up all night with them. My all-Indigenous band from Winnipeg was with me at the time. We spent all night at their studio. And I told them I wanted to turn Power in the Blood into a peace song. They just laughed and laughed, but they loved it. I did. I turned it into, instead of saying, and when that call it comes, I will be ready for war. That's what Alabama 3 had said. And I said, and when that call it comes, I will say no, no, no to war. And I just kind of rearranged the lyrics a little bit. So, yeah, you can do that. You can do that.
Buffy, I've also heard you lament the fact that we don't have a lot of great peace songs anymore in music. And you hear so many criticisms of pop music and nowadays that, oh, it's just so commercialized and there's no message, there's no feeling behind it. And what are your thoughts on contemporary music? And
listen to hip hop and rap. I mean, you hear a lot of protests going on, and indigenous rap and hip hop as well. So there is. It's not as though it's not there. I mean, a lot of people don't know the songs of Phil Oakes, who was a great protest songwriter, or Tom Paxton. And you know, in the '60s, Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Judy Collins, the ones who had real powerful management, like Albert Grossman and David Geffen, you know, Joni Mitchell's manager, everybody heard about what they were doing. But just like indigenous music right now, not everything is being heard. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's out there that we're just not hearing yet. I mean, there's an awful lot about indigenous life.